Welcome to Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine. I'm John Lawson. My guest today is Mariana Dezio. Mariana is Italian, she holds a doctorate in English literature, and teaches English at the Marymount International School in Rome. She is also a prolific scholar and translator. She's translated the novels Jane Eyre, A Testament of Youth, and Dracula, among others, from English into Italian. Welcome to Pittsburgh and to Robert Morris University, Mariana.
Thank you very much, John. It is my pleasure and my honor to be here with you today.
Well, I have a lot of questions for you. Let's start with the English language. How did you happen to take an interest in learning English and in researching English literature?
Well, as for English language, I've always had a passion for the language itself. I remember when I was a teenager, there used to be a program on English language every day after lunch. And I used to take notes, write down everything about that, you know, have a list of all the new vocabulary that I would learn. So I became really passionate about the language. And then living in Europe, it's easy for me to travel to the UK. And I did very often since, I've been doing it since I was, I don't know, 13 or 14 years old. And I simply took pride in speaking it, learning it. And then as for the literature, I remember in high school I had a wonderful teacher who made me love literature, English literature in particular, and Shakespeare, and Jane Austen as well. And then university, I decided to study literature as well, and then that's when and where I realized that it would be my future.
I'm impressed that as a native Italian speaker you could catch Shakespeare at that young age. There are many Americans who even late in life still haven't gotten Shakespeare. Language is quite difficult, isn't it?
Thank you. Oh yes, it is. It is. Actually, in high school we are required to study works in the original language. We don't really read the whole of Shakespearean plays in the original language, but we do read abstracts and of a lot of his plays in the original language. No editing, nothing, no abridged versions. So
this reminds me, speaking of comparisons and contrasts between American and Italian schools, you hold a PhD, you're quite a renowned researcher, and yet you teach high school and junior high school level students.
Yeah.
Is that typical in Italy, or?
Well, yes, it is, in a way, because it is really hard to have an academic job in Italy. I do teach at university, but as an adjunct, as a professor, doing all the things that a professor would do, all the, the dissertation supervising and so on and so forth. However, it's not a permanent, let's say, position. So it's something that gets renewed semester after semester, because it's really hard to get into a job, a proper job at university. So at the same time, you need to have another job allowing you to pursue your passions and the things that you like.
Yeah.
But it's quite, let's say, a frequent situation right now for scholars, young scholars, who want to keep on studying what they like, but there's no real possibility, no real chance for them to do it as a job.
Yeah.
So the best thing would be to do the job that you love and teach the things that you love as a job. That
sure.
would be, the perfect solution for a scholar, but it's not always like that.
Yeah. I'm interested in the translation process.
Mm-hmm.
Just could you name off the books that you've had, that you've translated and had published?
Well, my first translation, I started translating for money, first of all, because that's as well a job. And what you get to translate is usually, for example, a contract, or I remember translating a cookbook. Things that you happen to translate, you have to, you cannot say no. But then at some point I was asked to translate Jane Eyre, and that was a big thing for me, because ironically Jane Eyre was the first novel that I worked on when I started writing for academic purposes. So it made me, when they asked me to do that, it made me think, oh wow, this is my area. So that was my first, let's say, official translation. And then I translated Dracula, and then Sense and Sensibility. And then I've just finished translating A Testament of Youth by British feminist Vera Brittain, which is a memoir on World War I.
I seem to think that's been like a TV series or something.
It has it become a movie, uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, movie. Which is out now in the UK.
Yeah. I think it's available streaming here too, actually.
Oh yeah, is it?
Yeah,
good.
I believe so. So I have the impression, and you've just confirmed it, I think, that all of your translations have been from English into Italian,
yes.
Which from a global marketing perspective, let's say, seems a little, I'm not quite sure how to characterize it. I would think that there'd be a bigger market, let's put it this way, for translating things from Italian
mm-hmm.
into English.
Yeah, sure.
And do you avoid that for a particular reason, or have you just not had an opportunity yet?
Well, both things. However, being Italian, my native language, and not English, I feel much more comfortable translating into Italian, although I happen to translate something into English as well, but it's usually something easier than a classical novel, of course.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would feel the same level of confidence translating into English. I don't know. Maybe I should try, but
you certainly speak very idiomatically, it seems, and so
Thank you.
I would expect you not to have great difficulty achieving that level. But what do I know? Let's turn to your scholarship, which focuses a lot on 18th century woman writers.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a long time ago. How did you happen to get interested in the 18th century in the first place?
Well, I think the 18th century is not that far away, at least ideologically, from the world in which we live now. Because all I think, it's my personal belief, many of the things, that the situations, the events, the cultural issues that we have today in the world were already there during the 18th century. The philosophical background of the 18th century, which developed from the Enlightenment, then into the sort of neoclassical attitude, and then Romanticism, and then developed historically into events such as the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and so on. That's the background of who we are now, as I see it, from a European, let's say, European perspective. And I just thought that the 18th century has so much to offer still now to researchers, especially researchers on women writers, that it is worth working on it. There were so many women writers writing in the 18th century, many more than we can even think of. And most of them are totally unknown to all of us. So I think it's really worth researching on them and make them a little bit more known or available, at least, to contemporary readers.
You're listening to RMU Radio's Literature Out Loud. I'm John Lawson, and my guest today is Italian scholar and translator Mariana Dezio. Mariana, forgive my ignorance of Italian history and culture, but I'm surprised to learn that what you were just saying, that there were a lot of Italian women writers in the 1700s. I've always thought of Italian culture as being very patriarchal, with women's roles very carefully restricted to the home, get back to the kitchen kind of thing. But a lot of your research focuses on women actually exerting a lot of influence culturally
yeah.
and intellectually. That far back, especially through the medium, I believe, of salons.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And
yeah.
I'm not sure that is a concept familiar to many Americans. Would you describe what a salon in the 1700s would have been like?
Well, a salon or a coterie or a conversational circle would be a place in a private house, so an actual salon, where usually aristocratic families would have a large dinner with a lot of guests and have conversations, and then after dinner play cards and then drink chocolate and coffee and just enjoy the pleasures, really the pleasures of having a conversation. The thing is that in Italian large cities in the 18th century, they had a lot of European travelers, diplomats and ambassadors and so on, because Italy was not a full country, a country by itself. It was a patchwork of different states. So each state had its main focus in the principal city. For example, Florence, Milan, Turin, Venice, Rome, Naples, and so on. So travelers traveling on the Grand Tour would have to go to each of these cities and there mix with the aristocrats, the local important, let's say, people, and join their conversational circles, which would then become international. So this sort of private space slowly became public. It was in between being public and private.
Yeah.
And women had a very particular role in there because they were not politicians, they could not be diplomats, they could not be ambassadors, but they were the partners of ambassadors, diplomats, and so on. So they would accompany them over their journeys. And they would be the ones, from an Italian perspective, the ones hosting the conversation. So they had to be brilliant. They had to be well-educated, skilled in entertaining their guests. And therefore, they were the leaders of the conversation. And since we also had a lot of European women travelers there, then there's evidence, like correspondence and journals and diaries, of a lot of exchanges between these women travelers from France, Britain, and Germany to Italy, and Italian so-called salonières, who would host these circles. And these interactions are the basically what I'm working on right now. Because rather than being just, you know, places for conversation, they would exchange a lot of ideas, intellectual ideas. For example, translations going on between one and another in several languages. I can think of a very good example, which is Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Woman. After having been published in Britain, therefore in English, it was translated into French, and it arrived in Italy, first of all, because it was sent by a French salonniere to an Italian woman journalist in Veneto. And then this journalist, whose name was Elisabetta Caminerturra, wrote a review of the Vindication. And therefore, one of her friends, who had a salon in Rome, a countess, wanted to have the volume, and she got the volume from France and sent it to Rome, so they had the French version, and then this version was then sort of translated into Italian. So this book that has, you know, a particular importance in the history of European thought from a woman's or a feminist, if you like, perspective,
sure,
arrived through all these passages thanks to the salons.
Yeah. What you've just been talking about and the kind of aristocratic basis for most of this intellectual work,
mm-hmm,
raises the question for me about your research into women's writing, especially in that era, as to whether there it just has an intrinsic aristocratic kind of bias,
mm-hmm,
and to what extent women of other classes would have been writing at this period.
Right, yeah, that's a very good question, because the salons basically nurtured the proliferation of works by women writers. Therefore, being aristocratic for many of them would imply being able to write and publish. But we have evidence of salons hosted by bourgeois women as well during the 18th century, and this would become more and more frequent into the 19th century. So of course it was easier to have to be able to afford having a salon for an aristocratic woman. But then it became easy for middle class women as well to have this sort of circles in their houses.
I can't help assuming that what you mean by bourgeois or middle class actually would be pretty high class in terms of economic status,
sure.
Though. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It wouldn't be the same as we think about that now, of course.
Right,
but
right.
Yeah, it would still be.
How would women get educated in those days? I guess, I could extend that question to include men as well. I mean, I assume that the upper classes had private education, but I also have the feeling that there wouldn't have been public education available to peasantry, say, or the working class.
No, but there's a very good point in what you said. I mean, there was private education. Of course, you had, these private teachers, preceptors, going to the houses of wealthy people and to teach them. However, it is also true that the first universities in Europe were the Italian ones. And in the 16th century, we have the first woman professor at the University of Bologna, if I'm not wrong about the time period. And that would be a model for all the women travelers from all over Europe to look at, because they would, every time they would travel to Bologna, they would think, oh, wow, this is the place in which we had the first woman professor at a university, which was, something exceptional, let's say.
Yeah. You've referred several times to this grand tour idea where sort of upper class women, I guess, traveled around Europe. When did that start and when did it stop or has it stopped?
Well, I would say it's always been like that, especially from France and Britain and Germany to Italy, usually in the 15th and 16th and 17th century, it would be for religious purposes that the travelers would go to Rome to see, the Vatican State mainly.
Yeah.
But then it turned, especially in the 18th century, it started to become pleasure. It was first of all a journey conceived for rich male heirs of, aristocratic families whose education would imply that they had to travel to the south because of the classical ruins, because of the education that they may enrich that way. So it was, let's say, banned from a woman's education. But then it developed into a real journey for pleasure, which would go beyond these sort of limitations, if you like. And then women started to join this sort of fascinating series of travelers, just swarming, that's the word that they would use, in Italian cities at the time. A very famous example in the 18th century is that of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who would first of all travel to Italy with her husband, who was an ambassador from Britain, and then they went back to Britain, and then she wanted to go back to Italy to travel. Well, she had a lover, an Italian lover there that she wanted to run after, and therefore she moved to the country, and she basically started, it was around 1741, 42, she basically started this long procession of women travelers to the country. But then after Napoleon, things changed, because it became, they started all the political and revolutionary movements in Italy to gain independence and the unification of the country. And it was much more dangerous to travel to the south. That wouldn't imply that they decided not to travel there anymore, but the purpose of their traveling to Italy changed completely. It moved from being for pleasure only and for learning about the classical world and the Renaissance and so on. It changed into being a sort of a participatory movement into the revolutionary uprisings.
Yes. Let me just say, you're listening to RMU Radio's Literature Out Loud. I'm John Lawson, and my guest today is Italian scholar and translator Mariana Dezio. Talking about that revolutionary era in Italy, when Italy was achieving its unification and its independence, I think we associate that period with names like Garibaldi and mm-hmm. Mazzini. I gather that Italian women played a large role in that struggle as well. Could you comment on that?
Oh, well, yeah, they did. They did, although they're not remembered in history books. Actually, when you think about the Risorgimento, the resurgence, the movement that led to the Italian independence, and the riots that started in the 1820s, you think about names like Mazzini, Garibaldi, all these heroes of Italian history, but you never have, you know, an idea of the role that women actually played in all that. They were not just, you know, there as a sort of a background, but they were prompting actions, if not acting themselves. So their role would be that of even, I don't know, writers, for example, of pamphlets and books and volumes to celebrate the heroes of the revolutions, or as salonniers, again, to host circles to discuss issues related to the revolution or to organize actions, or they would join Garibaldi themselves and fight with him and accompany him in his several expeditions throughout the country, which is an extreme that is not in a way, it's not at all studied right now. They're not in history books at all.
I attended your lecture the other day at Pitt and was struck by some of the images you showed of Italian women of the revolutionary era packing rifles on their shoulders and such.
Yeah, indeed.
You certainly are a very energetic and active, multifaceted Italian woman.
Wow, thank you.
It seems that you probably have had some role models of very powerful Italian women who've been some of your big influences.
Yeah, I did. Although I don't want to think about women, well, yes, I do, and I don't want to have role models because I believe in equality. However, when I think about possible role models that I had in my past, I think about grandmothers, my grandmother in particular, Italian grandmothers who actually experienced the war, especially World War II, and so they developed their approach to life, their attitude, the attitude that they then passed on to their daughters and granddaughters. And that was extremely important to me in my personal life. So my grandmother is still alive, luckily, so I'm a lucky person.
Yeah.
And she has all these memories about the war that I treasure as a very important teaching for my own life. And then my mother as well, and then my teachers at university, probably, and then my colleague, who is an American, a colleague that I had at the school that I teach right now in Rome, Marymount International School, who is from Pittsburgh.
Oh.
Her name is Dr. Yvonne Hannigan. She has been a role model for me,
uh-huh.
a model of a woman who has, you know, the strength and enthusiasm and willingness to try herself at a lot of things. So that's a very good example for me.
So your activities have brought you to our shores. I assume that you came here mainly for the weather.
Sure, of course.
I should add that We have a high temperature today of something around 15 degrees in Pittsburgh. So I'm joking, of course. But by the way, what's the weather like around now in Rome?
Well, in Rome, it's 15 degrees as well, Celsius.
Celsius, slightly different, yeah.
It's quite warmer than here, yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful weather, yeah. It's what I miss. Well,
so why did you separate yourself to come to our cold climes on this particular trip?
Well, there's in Pittsburgh, there is one of the branches of the Società Dante Alighieri, which is an association dealing with studies around and about Dante and Italian literature in general. And I was invited to give a talk for them this last Sunday. And I talked about women writers and the impact that Garibaldi had on them. So that's the main purpose of my visit to the States. And I'm really pleased to be here. Besides the weather, it's fine. That may happen.
I gather that you do quite a bit of traveling.
Yes, I do. Yeah. For conferences mainly, but I try and put together, you know, conferences with something nice to see as well. I have a conference scheduled for May. I'm traveling to the University of Valarna in Sweden because there's within a project that they're developing with the University of, oh my gosh, somewhere. I think it's the University of Zimbabwe and the Larna University in Sweden. It's a project about the literature of immigrants to Europe and how they use European languages in their works.
Oh.
And I'm working on a writer who's quite famous right now in Italy, although he's not still recognized as a writer in the canon. He's naturalized Italian, but originally Algerian. And his Italian is, to me, just fabulous. So his way of, you know, the ways in which he employs Italian is simply fantastic. So I wanted to research a little bit more on that.
What's his name?
Amara Lacus.
Mm-hmm. Before we stray too far from the status of Italian women, I just wanted to follow up and get a sense of your, well, I have the feeling that women's participation in politics mm-hmm. isn't always progressive. For example, I think of Mussolini's granddaughter mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. being involved in politics in a right-wing sort of way.
Yeah.
What is your evaluation of kind of the state of Italian women's rights and abilities to express themselves in Italian culture right now?
Well, I never, as a teenager, as a university student, as a woman working in today's world in Italy, I never felt discriminated or not having the same rights as male workers or male professors or a male student when I was at university. So I wouldn't really see that as an issue right now. But I have to say that culturally, from a more general perspective, maybe when you live within a culture, you don't realize a lot of things. Maybe from the outside, there could be, you know, areas, let's say, in which women are less considered, or I don't want to say discriminated, because it doesn't sound like a word that I would use in 2015 in Italy, but there might be areas in which there's still a lot of work to do.
Thank you for giving that very coherent response to a not very coherent question. I appreciate that. What's next for you? What I mean, you've mentioned the Algerian Italian writer. Mm-hmm. What else do you have in prospect in terms of your work?
Well, I'm working on a book on these connections, on the connections that I was talking about, connections between British women writers traveling on the Grand Tour, meeting Italian salonieres and having these cultural exchanges or translations or correspondence. That's one of the things that I'm working on. And then I have several projects as well. There's another one on 18th century utopian writers. There's an Italian woman writer who was actually a princess in Turin who wrote a utopian novel in French, however. and that goes into a European genre of the time, which is utopian literature by women writers. And so that's another thing. Yeah, so far I have enough to work on for
a couple of
years.
Yeah. I've been talking with my guest, Mariana D'Ezio, an Italian scholar and translator. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Mariana.
Thank you very much for inviting me here.
Been a great pleasure. This has been Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine. I'm John Lawson. Thanks for listening.